Welcome to the Focus Today podcast with Perry Atkinson.
Well, welcome to Focus Today. I'm your host, Perry Atkinson. And of course, we have been watching the rise of anti-Semitism around the world at a rate that's amazing. Beyond our imagination. And I am so honored to have back with us today Dr. Andrew Bostrom. He's the author of several books, including The Legacy of Jihad and The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism. He's also published articles and commentaries on Islam in Washington Times, National Review, Online, and FrontPageMagazine.com, American Thinker, and other online publications. He does have a website, Andrew Bostrom, BOSTOM.org, Andrew Bostrom, and you can correspond with him there. Dr. Bostrom, good to see you again, friend. Thanks for your time. How are you?
Good to see you, Perry.
It's been 6 months now since October 7th, and the anti-Semitism rise across the landscape is amazing, not only in Muslim countries, but even in Western countries. How do you explain and how do we wrap our head around this anti-Jewish sentiment?
I think it's coming from two main sources. You know, you mentioned Muslim populations, but also I think I'll give you an example. There are these major demonstrations. I don't know if you're aware of this, planned throughout the world on April 15th, if you look at who's organizing this, it appears to be Marxist organizations, and so I think that you're seeing the confluence of both hard left and Islamic Muslim anti-Semitism. Sure, there are some vestiges of, you know, marginal neo-Nazis, but the main sources appear to be coming from the radical left, the Marxist left, and from the Muslim communities. There is something perverse that we've seen this explode really in coordination with October 7th, almost. You could say that Israel's response, you know, has perhaps sharpened the problem, but what's shocking is that it was apparent before the IDF even mobilized to launch some sort of, you know, counter operation. That's what's been truly shocking, Perry. So it's as if there was some coordination from the outset. You know, so you have this horrible carnage on October 7th, 2023, 6 months ago. Which was literally the largest slaughter of Jews since the end of the Holocaust, and in fact, per capita, one of the worst terrorist attacks in the last 50 years. Within hours, literally, there was this mobilization of again, hard left forces, pro jihadist forces. It's been shocking, and now, of course, you know, with Israel's response and the destruction that's taken place in Gaza with Hamas completely embedded within in the civilian population, now there's an excuse, but again, to me, the most stunning thing was that before Israel even retaliated, there was this explosion of anti-Semitism.
So let's go back to the beginning here. Wasn't Gaza a test two-state solution with a ceasefire?
Yeah. There had been. Actually, very, very interesting farming settlements in Gaza that were Jewish settlements. They as part of an attempt to have a peaceful solution, they were dismantled. They were actually dedicated to the Gazans and promptly destroyed, and instead of being preserved. And the Israeli citizens who lived there were withdrew, and ultimately there was a form of an election in Gaza. The local population voted in Hamas, and Hamas has never relinquished power. Remains very popular, though. I don't think that they would be voted out if there were free and open elections. Israel has been on the other side of a fence, it's just incredible that people forget this. It did happen in 2005, 2006. This wasn't 40 years ago.
Does the Quran actually call for the elimination of the Jew?
Well, it's different. It really reads like an indictment, conviction, and punishment process that is developmental. It's very it's hard to find a more anti-Semitic, certainly religious text than the Quran. In the opening surah or chapter of the Quran. Which is very, Perry, the Quran is difficult for people that aren't familiar with it to understand, even in translation, in a familiar language, because it doesn't have a typical developmental narrative. It doesn't. The arrangement is simply longest to shortest. In other words, the longest chapters are up front. And then they get progressively shorter. The one exception to that is the opening chapter called the Fatiha, which means the opening. It's a very short chapter of seven verses. The first six verses are basically talking about the beneficence of Allah and His mercy, et cetera, et cetera. And then the seventh verse warns Muslims to follow the straight path, i.e. Islam, not the path of those who've engendered Allah's anger, which are the Jews, and those who've gone astray, who are the Christians. And how do we know that's what the verse actually refers to when it says those two things? Because there's a tradition of Muhammad which says specifically those who've incurred or engendered Allah's anger are the Jews, and those who've gone astray are the Christians. About 13 centuries now of Quranic commentaries, about 90% of them make those references clear to the Jews and the Christians. But this is repeated 17 times a day. So there are five prayer sessions, but the Fatiha, which subdivides these prayer sessions, introduces and subdivides them, is repeated 17 times a day. So it's a profound form of indoctrination. And of course, that theme of incurring anger is melded to Quranic verses, which basically identifies supposedly these permanent negative characteristics of the Jews, refer to their being cursed. If you've heard this epithet where Jews are referred to as apes or apes and pigs, that's a reference to another part of the Quran where the reference to apes certainly appears three times and the reference to pigs occurs just once. And so you have a very, very dark portrayal of Jews, but also all non-Muslims, including including Christians. But the hatred of the Jews in the Quran is amplified by the traditions of Muhammad, and also by his biography, his sacralized Muslim biography, where he reaches out to the Jews initially as ostensibly as their prophet. They reject him, and then he wages a sort of a proto-jihad against them, which with all the things that, relate to now historical jihad, massacre, pillage, enslavement, deportation. And he is the idealized man for Muslims. There's clearly a very strong religious component to it. It's amplified by contemporary Islam's major teaching institutions like Al-Azhar University, where these themes are repeated over and over and are inculcated to all those that seek religious education at Al-Azhar University, and which includes, you know, imams that fan out across the world. And I would say, Perry, right after October 7th itself, so this is happening in real time, Al-Azhar issued a statement celebrating what Hamas did as resistance. That's all they said. They mentioned nothing about the carnage that was inflicted upon the civilian population in southern Israel. And then by October 18th, 19th, Al-Azhar actually issued a fatwa, a formal religious edict, which declared that the lives of Israeli citizens, all citizens, not just the IDF, were legitimate targets of jihad. And what is so striking about this is not that it's happening, not that Al-Azhar, you know, issued such a fatwa, because they've issued similar fatwas calling for a jihad against the Jews of Israel and historical Palestine, literally since before at the time of the partition plan in 1947, and certainly during the 1948 war and in the major wars since then. But what's striking is the complete lack of reaction from the outside world. Here is a major religious teaching organization sanctioning a real genocide, the jihad annihilation of the Jews of modern Israel, and it's stated without comment.
I think you just hit the nail on the head. Why it makes it even more confusing that when you have an open declaration of annihilation of a group of people on the world stage, that it doesn't go challenged. By the way, let me say to our viewers and listeners, Dr. Boston's book is entitled The Legacy of Jihad, and the other one is The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism. There's a picture of the covers on the book, of the books on the screen there. Dr. Boston, a couple of quick questions before I run out of time. I know this is a big question. I don't know if there's a short answer to it. What's the unique difference between the Shiites and the Sunnis?
I would say it's just really who should inherit the caliphate, really. That's where the split occurs. There are four caliphs, four major Muslim leaders that are supposed to lead the community after Muhammad's death, and there's a split with Caliph Ali, who was rejected by the majority of Muslims, who became the Sunnis, and is accepted by the Shia. In terms of so much of Islamic doctrine, it's identical, and certainly the animus towards non-Muslims and Jews in particular is shared by both, and that's why you see, you know, obviously look at the major Shiite country, which is Iran. And it's virulently anti-Semitic and behind a lot of the jihadism against Israel.
So the enemy of my enemy being my friend, i.e. the Abraham Accord, just kind of sitting there for a while, right?
Well, look, the Abraham Accords, I think, are very useful because there are as a tactical, as a real politic kind of, however cold the relations are between Israel and these Sunni countries, they do have a common enemy. I think the idea that there's going to be meaningful cultural exchanges and things like that, I mean, I think that's ridiculous. However, in terms of real politic, if the Sunni countries and Israel, you know, appropriately feel threatened by Iran, I think it's very appropriate that they, you know, exchange information, et cetera. But, compare the idea that they're going to become, you know, true allies and have on a cultural level, I think is a pipe dream. However, taking advantage of that tactical alliance was something that the Trump administration, to its credit, promoted And I think we had, in that brief, period of his presidency, we had more stability. We had, instead of isolating Israel, it was the jihadist movement amongst the Palestinian Muslims and Iran that were being isolated. And I think that was, at least in that short period of time, was fairly effective in reducing the level of tension.
One last question. I only have you for one segment. I'll get you back. There's a lot of pressure for a ceasefire, negotiations for hostages, pulling out of southern Gaza, all that. It doesn't appear to be that Netanyahu is going to be waived or swayed by this. When Ramadan ends tonight, I guess there's going to be further fighting. Do you see a ceasefire at all on the horizon?
Well, again, this is interesting about the reporting. In Egypt, the negotiations as of yesterday for a ceasefire, which even our State Department, or at least elements of our State Department, reported that Hamas rejected, just flat out rejected a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And I don't see enough reporting of this. I mean, this literally happened yesterday. It's very difficult to understand why the perceptions are so warped about this. I mean, Hamas is very clear what its intentions are. The eradication, certainly of Israel and Israeli Jews, but frankly, more broadly, they're pretty annihilationist in vis-a-vis Jews worldwide. I don't see how this conflict is going to end with a ceasefire. I think there could be a temporary ceasefire, but I don't think the conflict overall will end. There is a ceasefire.
Dr. Bostrom, you're fascinating. I look forward to having you back. Let me say to our viewers, check out both his books, The Legacy of Jihad and The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism. This gentleman has done his research in this area. There's a picture of the cover on the of the book on the screen. He does have a website, Andrew Bostom, BOSTOM.org. Check it out there. Thank you, Doctor. Look forward to more visits.
Thank you, Perry.
Thank you for listening to this week's Focus Today podcast. Remember, you can visit our website to check out all the interviews we did this week on our daily Focus Today TV show at thedove.us. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us and share it with your friends.